from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Tomorrow marks the one-year anniversary of President Bush's Top Gun celebration on the flight deck of the USS Lincoln. But the mission accomplished banner was looking wildly premature this week. Fierce, difficult fighting in Fallujah and Najaf. Mortifying images of abused Iraqi prisoners inflaming the country and the region. More dead American soldiers in April than in the entire six-week drive to take Baghdad. And little faith anywhere in the trend lines of this conflict. Some are saying it's time to go, to get out. More are insisting America must succeed. With 135,000 troops in Iraq, 40% of which are Reserve and National Guard, many in Washington say thousands more are needed, and talk of bringing back the draft is in the air. For numbers, for fairness, for sharing the burden of war, tonight on Point, we'll talk with Republican Senator Chuck Hagel of Nebraska on Iraq, and then hear a pro and con debate on bringing back the draft. But first, more controversy over acknowledgement of America's war dead in Iraq. On tonight's broadcast of the ABC News program Nightline, anchor Ted Koppel will read aloud the names and show pictures of every one of the more than 700 U.S. servicemen and women who have died in Iraq. ABC says the broadcast, entitled The Fallen, is intended to honor those who have given their lives. Critics say it's anti-war propaganda. One company, the Sinclair Media Group, has pulled the broadcast from its eight ABC affiliates, including stations in St. Louis, Columbus, Ohio, and Springfield, Massachusetts. That move prompted Senator John McCain to send a letter to Sinclair's CEO, calling the decision not to air the show unpatriotic and a gross disservice to the public and to the men and women of the United States Armed Forces. Leroy Sievers is executive producer of Nightline. I asked him to explain why Nightline decided to read the names.
Since the war, Nightline has been doing a feature called The Line of Duty, where we're reporting on all of the casualties. And we realized that we've been saying, you know, two soldiers were killed in this incident, three Marines were killed in this incident. And our concern was that they were just becoming numbers and that people weren't paying attention anymore. And so we're looking for a way to sort of humanize, to say these are individuals. I mean, Ted and I were embedded in the 3rd ID during the invasion, and we got to know them, the soldiers, as individuals. We wanted to somehow get that across to the audience. So we thought about profiling a couple, you know, going to their families, going to their hometowns, but how do you pick 5 or 10 out of 700? And so a number of us remembered the Life magazine issue from 1969 during Vietnam, and that sort of led to, well, why don't we try something like that?
And describe what Life did in 1969.
Those were, I mean, I grew up with Vietnam on the television. I remember the weekly body counts. And Life magazine, which was then sort of the magazine. I mean,
very big.
You know, that people realize it was bigger than Time and Newsweek and all of that. Did a spread where they showed the pictures and the names of all the soldiers who had been killed in Vietnam in 1 week.
And that, 11 pages, 1 week's dead.
Right, and that stuck with me all these years.
I wonder, in 1969 was a point where the Vietnam War had been going on for a while. Public opinion was beginning to turn against it. Is it your sense that in the Iraq engagement that the U.S. public, the public opinion, is at that hinge point?
No, and that's not why we chose to do it. I mean, we're not trying to drive opinion one way or the other, or a change in opinion isn't driving us. What our thinking was, you know, if you're for the war or if you're against it, it doesn't matter in that these men and women are over there serving in our names, and those that have been killed have made the ultimate sacrifice in our names. And so we figured it was the least we could do to recognize that. Again, I think if you support the war, then this is probably a cost worth bearing. If you don't, any cost would be too high. To our thinking, that doesn't matter. These men and women have paid this cost, and you know, whether you think it's in a just cause or not, that sacrifice has to be recognized.
What has the Sinclair Broadcast Group said to you or said publicly about why they are not planning to air the Nightline listing?
Well, they issued a statement that obviously we disagree with, certainly questioning Ted's objectivity and journalistic ethics, which we reject categorically.
Ted Koppel, of course, was a correspondent in Vietnam. Has he spoken on the air about parallels between Iraq and Vietnam?
I don't believe so. I mean, it may have come up in interviews. I mean, we do a lot of broadcasts on Iraq and Afghanistan and the war on terrorism. It doesn't spring to mind. It's possible. I mean, someone goes through all the transcripts over the last year. It's very possible, but nothing springs to my mind.
And you know, you're taking flack from, as you might expect, from a wider range of voices as well. Brent Bozell at the Media Research Center, kind of conservative media watchdog group, saying it's intellectually dishonest to deny the partisan nature of this broadcast. Of course it's partisan. What's the purpose? There's only one goal in mind, is to turn public opinion against the war. Brent Bozell.
Well, it's interesting to me. I mean, I wonder if some of these same people are going to be out protesting or demanding that there be no Memorial Day observances. I didn't realize that acknowledging America's war dead was a political statement, was pro-war, anti-war, or left or right or whatever. Ted and I have both been in combat. Ted's, I think, done 13 or 14 wars. I've done 13 or 14. We have seen men die in combat. And quite honestly, anyone that would question our motives or accuse us of manipulating those deaths and abusing that sacrifice is beneath contempt.
Leroy Severs, describe for us exactly what the format will be tonight. How will you go through these names?
It'll be a little different. Ordinarily with Nightline, we have a produced open that's sort of a preview of the show, and then Ted does his introduction. We're off and running. We'll simply start with the title of the broadcast, The Fallen. Ted will do an introduction saying what we're doing and why, and then we will simply show the pictures and read the names. We do have commercials. We talked with the network, and they were certainly open to the idea. I think all of us would prefer there weren't. The problem is that for any network broadcast, there are local commercials, there are network commercials. We could take the network's one out, but you'd have to go to each local station, which would have to go to each individual advertiser, and it just became impossible to do. So there's just no way to take care of that.
You've got more than 500 killed in action and 200-plus non-combat deaths. Will they all fit in your normal broadcast period?
Well, we've actually been extended. We thought, because of time constraints, we were only going to do those killed in combat, which is not something any of us felt particularly good about. I got a call the other day from a father whose son had been wounded, had been decorated for heroism, and was on the way back from the front in a truck in Iraq, and the truck turned over and his son was killed. Mm. And he was in tears and said, how could you possibly not include my son? And it was so moving and so strong that we went to the network and said, look, we need more time, and they gave it to us immediately.
Leroy Severs, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Leroy Severs is executive producer of Nightline. He spoke with me from Washington. Republican Senator Chuck Hagel of Nebraska enlisted in the military in 1967, served a year in Vietnam, and received two Purple Hearts. Now, as a leading member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he has pushed for recruitment of 30,000 more Army troops and for a renewed national debate about reinstating the draft. Earlier today, I spoke with Senator Hagel and asked his assessment of how the U.S. effort in Iraq is going.
Tom, this is a very complicated and dangerous situation that we find ourselves in. It should be no surprise that we are having great difficulty in Iraq. We're having great difficulty because we're engaged in something that we've never been engaged in before. We're dealing with an area of the world that has no tradition or culture in representative government. It is complicated religiously, ethnically, tribally. So we shouldn't be surprised that we've got the kind of difficulties that we are facing. What's important now is to continue to work with the United Nations, with our allies, with the Iraqi people, because the objective is to move the Iraqi people in a position as soon as we can of self-governance and self-defense. And that really is the objective, and we should not stray from that.
Senator Kerry said today, looking out on Najaf and Fallujah and all the rest, that Iraq is reaching a moment of truth, that failure is all too likely there, in his words, if there aren't some significant changes. President Bush, today defending progress that's been made there, said, we're making progress, you bet. Which is closer to your view?
Well, there is progress that has been made in Iraq over the last year, but at the same time, we are a long way from any kind of a definable victory, a definable achievement. And that definition, at least in my mind, is an Iraqi government that would represent the interests of the Iraqi people, the Iraqi people, governing themselves and defending themselves. There's no guarantee, by the way, of how this all turns out. I hope that we can stay focused on the timelines here of handing as much authority as possible over to a yet undefined Iraqi government entity on July 1st. The elections are scheduled then in January. I think it's important those elections go forward. The Iraqi people will make their own choices. But this is still very unpredictable and very uncertain as to the outcome.
I want to ask you specifically about how those things might happen. Before I do, your reactions to some of the things we've been seeing so much of on television and hearing about on the radio. First of all, Fallujah, the bodies hanging from the bridge, and then this major U.S. effort that appears not to have been entirely successful. What do you take away from what's happened there, Senator Hagel?
Well, again, I think it reflects on the complications and the dangers that exist in Iraq. There are dynamics here that we don't quite understand. I don't think that they are representative of all or even a majority of the people in Iraq, but nonetheless, they are real issues that we are dealing with. And again, it seems to me that which should have been the objective right from the front end of this effort, that working with the Iraqi people, have to have an appreciation and a perception that the American purpose in Iraq is to help them, is humanitarian as any one thing, to improve their lives so that they have hope, they have some opportunities to build a nation for themselves. Let's not forget that nations are built from the inside out, not the outside in, and occasionally great powers forget that lesson.
Are you comfortable seeing today a former general in Saddam Hussein's army going into Fallujah in his Iraqi army uniform to take over with other Iraqi soldiers security in that city?
One of the great mistakes we made was disbanding the Iraqi army when we invaded. When we did that, we pushed out all of the components of any kind of a structural institution, which almost always historically you use to put back and build back or help build back a country. But we didn't do that. And so if there is to be any future for Iraq, certainly defining it by getting control of some security, then the Iraqi people must be part of that. The Iraqi people must lead that. We can help. So a former Iraqi general in Saddam Hussein's army leading that, or two or three, is what's going to be required here. We the United States, cannot police and securitize Iraq on its own. We have to be working with the Iraqi people, and the Iraqi people themselves have to want security and stability more than we do.
And yet, looking at another part of Iraq, in Najaf, in the area where there's been the Shiite Mahdi army out in the streets in so many cities in recent weeks, Iraqi security forces simply melted away when this challenge came. Are you confident that in Fallujah or in Najaf in the Shiite south, that Iraqi forces will actually pick up the mission that the United States would like and complete it?
Well, no, I'm not confident of that, if for no other reason than the example that you've just mentioned, a recent example of how a so-called Iraqi force would not engage other Iraqis. And I think that's, again, a point we're missing here and that we have overlooked. When you are asking Iraqis to fight Iraqis, that's not an automatic, and therefore, again, I go back to the common denominator here, and that is the Iraqi people working with themselves and in their own institutional structures are going to have to make it work. And that may, in the end, to some extent, cut across the interests of the United States. But we must be prepared to accept what the majority of the Iraqi people want. Now, you talk about the religious dynamic of this. The facts are that the Islamic political dynamic there in Iraq is very powerful and very strong, and I think the possibilities are very real that you could end up in Iraq with some kind of a theocracy, maybe an Islamic republic. I don't know, but that, again, is going to have to be determined by the Iraqi people, and the United States is going to have to be in a position to accept that.
Republican Senator Chuck Hagel, earlier today, we'll hear more of my interview with the senator after a break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the situation in Iraq and renewed calls for a national debate on a military draft. Let's return now to a conversation I had earlier today with Republican Senator Hagel of Nebraska. Senator Chuck Hagel, you've said in recent days that the United States needs to have a debate, at the least, about reinstituting a military draft. What are your thoughts on that as you look out on the situation in Iraq today?
When you look at the commitments that the United States is making, has made, will continue to make of force structure around the world, we are stretched as thin as we have been since World War II in putting our men and women in uniform around the globe. Currently 135,000 men and women in Iraq. 40% of those are from the reserves and National Guard. We've extended the tours of all these groups over there. You can't continue to sustain that kind of manpower commitment around the world without something breaking. It's just impossible. So therefore, and if this is a generational war, if this is a challenge of our time, and I think it's a very serious challenge, terrorism, proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, then we're going to have to prepare ourselves to match the mission with the force, with the resources. And that means we're going to have to look beyond next year and the year after as to how are we going to come up with the kind of force structure required to fulfill our security commitments around the world. I think a national mandatory service in some of some kind for all of our people might be something that we would want to seriously consider. I'm not proposing that. I'm not proposing reinstitution of a draft. But the longer we defer these tough choices and decisions, the more critical it becomes. And certainly we don't want to put this country in a position where it becomes a crisis, where we're going to have a retention recruitment problem in the reserves and National Guard and even the active duty Army. I think the Army, active duty Army today is far too thin. I think it's far too small, especially when you're considering what we're asking these people to do. And we're going to have to increase that Army. Even the Chief of Staff of the Army, who I met with this morning, General Schumacher, and others have said, yes, we need more people. Well, of course we need more people. And that's just the reality of what we're dealing with. So we need to start talking about this and not be intimidated by the great challenges of our time.
But, you know, Senator Hagel, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld said just last week that he did not know of anyone in the executive branch who believes it would be, his words, appropriate or necessary to reinstitute the draft. Is Secretary Rumsfeld being realistic here?
Well, I can't answer for Secretary Rumsfeld, but I would remind you that Secretary Rumsfeld has also said that we don't need any increase in our manpower, when in fact many of his generals on active duty say we do. So Secretary Rumsfeld has his opinion. I'm sure that he is correct in that there is no one actively engaged in this administration right now looking at the possibility of any kind of a draft. That may be correct. I'm not second-guessing the Secretary on that point. But the fact is, we are going to break our Army. We're going to break our force structure the way we're going. We can't possibly continue to fulfill the commitments that we're making overseas for the security interests of this country. I am convinced of that, and many generals agree with that.
Senator Hagel, a final question. We've all seen the photos in the last day or two of Iraqi prisoners apparently being abused by U.S. troops in Iraq. Why has this happened? How serious a breach do you consider it?
Well, it's very serious, and it's disgusting, and it is beneath the dignity of most all of our great young men and women who are serving overseas. It certainly does not represent who we are as a country or our military or the high standards and ethics of the military. Unfortunately, some soldiers in Iraq perpetrated this. They need to be punished for that. I am confident that the investigations are ongoing, that there will be appropriate punishment. That is the worst kind of behavior, the most irresponsible behavior that can be perpetrated on anyone. We need to deal with it quickly, and we need to deal with it fairly. But those responsible must pay a high price, because that is not the American military, and it's especially important that the rest of the world, especially the Iraqi people, the Arab world, see that we will not tolerate that kind of behavior in our soldiers.
Senator Chuck Hagel, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Republican Senator Chuck Hagel of Nebraska, he spoke with us from Washington. We're talking tonight about Iraq, about global instability, and whether it is time for Uncle Sam to bring back the military draft. You can join the conversation tonight. Is it time to broaden the circle of Americans carrying the weight of war? Do we need to revive the draft to fill out the ranks of the U.S. military? Is it an issue of need or an issue of fairness? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight from Santa Monica, California, is Charles Moskos, sociology professor at Northwestern University and author of All That We Can Be, Black Leadership and Racial Integration the Army Way. He was drafted in the U.S. Army Combat Engineers from 1956 to 1958. Good evening and welcome, Charles Moskos.
Thank you very much.
It's good to have you. Also with us from New York tonight is David Greenberg, professor of political science and history at Yale University and author of Nixon's Shadow, The History of an Image. His recent op-ed in the Christian Science Monitor is Calls for a Military Draft Promote Illusion of Equality. Good evening and welcome, David Greenberg.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Charles Moskos, first to you. Here's Senator Chuck Hagel saying very bluntly that the military is strapped as it's been since World War II, and that if something isn't done, it's going to, his words, break. He's saying we need a vigorous national conversation about mandatory service, about the draft. Do you agree?
Absolutely. Even more, I would go further and say it's time to bring back the draft. But certainly we do need the debate. As Senator Hagel and others have pointed out, including Congressman Rangel, the shrinking number of veterans, by the way, on the Hill, both wounded veterans, do say that we do need some kind of a discussion or bring back the draft. It would have to be a 21st century draft, though, in which there'd be different tiers. The military draft, homeland security needs, which are not being met, and thirdly, civilian service is another option. But the main point is, as the senator pointed out, there are two reasons. We have an overstretched military, which nobody can deny, and the question about fairness is also there as well. You don't get fairness, by the way, necessarily in a draft, as the Vietnam War era draft proved. The question is, how do you get a fair draft? And that you can do in certain ways, as we had during the Cold War draft. My contemporary, by the way, as a draftee, was Elvis Presley.
Mm-hmm.
So you can imagine if Eminem would join the Army today, what that would mean.
Or if he were drafted.
You might need a waiver, by the way.
I can imagine. You might. I want to hear more about what you mean by 21st century draft. But David Greenberg, I want to get your first impression on this. Chuck Hagel is nobody's fool. Been in the military himself. Charles Moskos drafted himself in the Korean War. But you've looked at the history of the draft in the United States. And as I understand, you're not for it. Why not?
Well, I think the point that Professor Moskos just made about Vietnam not having been a very fair draft, if you look at the history of the draft, first of all, we haven't had a draft very often. And second, when we have had it, it has usually been quite unfair. And so the notion that it promotes a certain kind of fairness, that we're all in it together, is something we can, on the one hand, comfort ourselves with, while on the other hand, not actually seeing in practice. You know, for a long time, the practice was you could buy yourself out of the draft. You could hire a replacement.
In which wars are you speaking of?
Well, up through the Civil War, that was the case. The Civil War was, referred to as a rich man's war, but a poor man's fight. And the New York City draft riots of 1863 were largely a result of these unfair practices where, you know, poor working stiffs couldn't buy their way out, whereas the wealthier folk could. So,
and of course, in the Vietnam War, if you were in college, you weren't drafted, and so on. Another kind of socioeconomic line drawn there.
Exactly. And it sounds to me, although I think that the idea of a homeland service or other kinds of national service in lieu of military service are well-intentioned, I wonder whether they wouldn't promote the same kinds of invidious problems that we've seen in other drafts of the past.
So you're looking at history and saying history doesn't show us that the draft brings fairness. What about the issue, and I'll put this to Charles Moskos as well, but what about the issue of need? Senator Hagel is saying we are going to break this fine military we've built if we don't bulk it up.
Well, if you're putting that to me,
yes,
I think that is a view that comes from sharing the Bush administration's fundamental assumptions about the war on terrorism, and having a war on terrorism that can include such things as the war in Iraq, which many of us see as very different things, and that the war in Iraq was a war of choice, not a war of necessity. I think.
Are you saying then that your opposition to the draft on the need front rests on a presumption that there's not going to be the need, that the world is not as scary a place in need of patrolling as the White House says?
Exactly. I mean, I think during World War II, you could make the case that we did need a draft, that the threat from Nazi Germany and the Axis powers was such that it was necessary to, for a limited time, conscript, you know, any possible able-bodied young male. I think, you know, there are times certainly when a draft can be justified. I don't see the current world situation as being one.
But the troops are in Iraq and they are stretched. Charles Moskos.
Well, we know that it is stretched, and you know, Dave Greenberg has to come up a way then how you're going to understretch it.
Mm-hmm.
But the point here is about on the fairness side as well as the needs. Homeland security needs. You know, our borders are unprotected. Cargo ships, we don't know what's happening. Nuclear plants are unguarded. We should never even have that Transportation Security Agency set up. That should have been draftees except for the professional staff. When you have a draft army...
Oh, you mean the draftees would be doing airport security, for
example?
That's
right, as they do in Israel. The point here is that in World War, in my Princeton class of 1956, mm-hmm. out of 750 males, over 450 served. Last year at Princeton, out of 1,100 males and females, only 7 served. So
wow.
It's no longer equitably shared. In the Congress and the Senate, we have 535 members. Only 5 have children in the military. I mean, what we're now...
That is shocking.
It's patriotism light. And the other thing that hasn't been brought up on a pro-draft side is the costs of this volunteer force. It's not only small, but it's very expensive. And many of the new costs now are going into civilian contractors, which are not even put in the military personnel budget. It's sort of smoke and mirrors. They put it under operations. In a draft era, our senior sergeant would make 7 times the compensation of a private. Today, mm-hmm. that same senior sergeant makes 2.5 times the compensation of a private. We have...
I'm not sure I follow the point. What's the significance of that?
Well, we have overpaid recruits and underpaid professionals.
I see. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's what a draft
to keep the volunteers coming in, you're saying?
Yes, and yeah. keep them staying in.
Right, which is critical right now because Senator Hagel is saying that the big crisis will come if our volunteer army looks around after a couple of years of this Iraq strain and says, we all want out.
Well, we do have a draft now, but nobody admits it. It's called stop loss. They can't get out. When your term goes over. Right?
And, of course, Representative Rangel has said, David Greenberg, that we also, in a sense, have a draft now in that it tends to be people who perceive fewer economic opportunities who enter the military.
Well, I do think that is a real problem, and I wouldn't argue with that point at all. And I think there are clearly other ways of addressing you know, the deep-rooted economic and social inequalities we have. But it seems to me that it's, again, it's very easy for all of us here to talk about a draft now. In some ways, it'd be interesting to hear from, you know, the 18-year-olds, the 23-year-olds, those who would be subjected to this right now. It seems to me that some of the calls, I don't hear this at all from either Senator Hagel or Professor Moskos, but a lot of the calls are put forward in a rather cynical vein, which is out of an anti-war sentiment, and saying that, well, if we all really have to either ourselves or see our children be put to the draft, then we will be much more reluctant to go to war in the first place.
So you're saying it's a way of rubbing the whole country's nose in the fact of war. On the other hand, you can make the argument that the whole country should be feeling some of that burden that those soldiers in Iraq are carrying solely at this time.
Well, I do agree that we should all be feeling that burden, but I don't think that the draft is the way to do it. It seems to me to be a very cynical move, that I don't think the draft should be put to those kinds of political purposes.
What about drafting from the top of the social ladder? Start there.
Start with the Princeton class.
And start with Jenna Bush and Chelsea Clinton, too.
Well, you know, I mean, there are lots of ways we could come up with where we could feel that a draft would be more equitable. You know, and I think if it came to that, where we really felt it was necessary to sort of take, you know, there was a national consensus that the war on terrorism demanded the kind of universal sacrifice that, you know, the kind of consensus that World War II commanded, then I think,
here's an interesting thing, though, David and Tom, you'll be interested in this, and David's a historian on the matter. In early 1944, the only way you could enter the U.S. military was through the draft. They would not let you volunteer anymore because that greatest generation was volunteering too much for the Army, Air Corps, and the Navy, which were relatively safe services compared to the ground forces.
And I must say once more to David Greenberg's point, here we have Senator Hagel saying, hey, folks, this is the situation that we're facing. We do need something here. I want to get one call in before the break. Eric is calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Eric. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing tonight?
Just great.
I've just been listening while I've been traveling through the city here, and from the perspective of an active duty military officer whose opinions in no way reflect those of the United States Navy, I'd just like to say that, the all-volunteer force is by far a great thing. The quality of people that I have working for me and that I work for is has driven the need for the draft out the window, in my perception. And my question would be is, there's some question of a draft. Well, why do we keep cutting the funding for the all-volunteer force? If we need more people, then why do we continue to downsize?
So why not just pour money in there, make it more attractive, and keep the volunteer force going? Eric, thanks for your call. Charles Moskos, here's the point, and it's made by many military experts. They're saying, look, we've got a great fighting force here. The history of drafted fighting forces is not nearly as great. Let's stick with what we've got.
That's what Rumsfeld said, too. We fought World War II, basically, with a drafted or draft-motivated force. Two points to be made. With the caller didn't mention, we do have, as I stressed before, underpaid professionals and overpaid recruits.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's interesting that in the draft era, only 10% of the entering draftees did not finish their enlistment, which was a two-year term, during the peacetime era. The question now is, by the way, in the all-volunteer force, since its origins, over one-third of entering recruits who enter the all-volunteer force do not complete their initial enlistment, and they drop out for one reason or another. So we have this kind of interesting phenomenon that when the all-volunteer force, you have a higher dropout rate than you had during the draft.
But here you've got an active-duty officer saying, please don't give me draftees. I want my volunteer army.
Yeah, he's never worked with a draftee, obviously. I'm just giving you the historical record.
David Greenberg,
the draftees had a lower dropout rate in the Vietnam War than the regular Army volunteers.
Well, that is interesting. Though, of course, the mythology or the images that were left with David Greenberg are of a very disillusioned draft army in Vietnam.
But the volunteer army is pretty disillusioned, too, there.
Well, I think that's probably right, that it was across the board. But I think Vietnam put a stop to the draft for a very good reason, which is, there were just too many Americans who didn't want to see themselves or their loved ones subjected to a war that they either didn't believe in or they didn't believe was winnable or they felt had gone too far or for whatever reasons had come to turn against Vietnam.
Well, we got to take a short break. We understand that sentiment, but there's a war going on. It has to be fought. What do you think, listeners? Would a new military draft make the sharing of the burden of security more fair? Would it make the U.S. military more effective or not? And is talk of a draft a scare tactic, or is it getting real? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by Charles Moskos and David Greenberg. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Iraq, global instability, and whether it's time for Uncle Sam to bring back the draft. You can join the conversation. Is it time to broaden the circle of Americans carrying the weight of war, or time to make less war? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight from New York by David Greenberg, political science professor and professor of history at Yale University, and from Santa Monica, California, Northwestern University sociology professor Charles Moskos. Jerry's calling right now from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to make a quick comment. It seems that this might be the right time for all men and women after high school to serve the government in some way and with no exemptions. And then after they go into government service, it could be voluntary whether they actually went into the armed forces or not. And you might have a number of benefits in terms of government jobs that need to be done. And I think you actually have a huge benefit for the children to understand more about the world and they live in and how the government functions.
And Jerry, are you saying this is the
opportunity to make them, to have them grow up here?
And are you saying this is the moment for such a step because of threats to national security, or just to get to move out of the me generation and get some shared labor here?
I think this was a good idea any time in the last 25 or 30 years, and I think it's getting to be a better and better idea.
Jerry, thanks very much for your call. Let us pick it up. Charles Moskos, is this what you mean by a 21st century draft, not necessarily military?
Yes, it would be something along those lines. It might be different rewards for different tiers, whether it's the military or the Homeland Security or the civilian service. The initial step has to be, by the way, is we now give out about $20 billion a year in taxpayers' money to subsidize loans or give grants to college students.
Right.
That is a GI Bill without the GI. No federal aid should be given to a college student unless he or she does some form of service. You can't even get that through the Congress.
Well, David Greenberg, looking at history, what about the political viability of this? It may be a great idea. There's certainly a lot of things that need to be done in ports and airports and all kinds of security, just for starters. Can you imagine the political will being there?
Well, I mean, in a way, it sounds like an effort to kind of get past conservative anti-government sentiment that has been standing in the way, I think, of properly funding all kinds of government services for a number of years. Historically, I want to go back to, not just Vietnam, but also World War I, and this may not be directly to your question at first. There was great dissension at home sown by the draft in World War I and Vietnam because there wasn't a consensus behind those wars. And the price we paid at home was as costly as whatever we achieved overseas was beneficial. And I think
that's saying a lot.
Yeah, well, it certainly was. I mean, the brutality, the vigilantism, the Red Scare that followed in the wake of World War I, the repression of civil liberties was...
You're taking all that on the draft?
Well, not entirely as a result of the draft, but certainly it was a huge social issue that conscientious objectors were a staggeringly high number. They were often, not just stigmatized but brutalized.
But yet maybe it leads the society to a more honest and deep debate about its national and global security policy, if there is that involvement. I want to get one more call. Doris is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Doris. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you, Tom?
Great, Doris.
Hey, love your show.
Oh, thanks.
Okay, first of all, I do support the idea of a draft. I myself spent over 20 years in the military, okay?
Uh-huh.
And
as an enlisted person, I bet.
Pardon me?
I hope you were enlisted.
No, I was an officer.
Okay
but I did start out as enlisted, and then I did get out, went ROTC, and was commissioned.
Why do you support a draft, Doris?
Well, because I think it's everyone's responsibility to... give something back to this country, okay? And in particular, one of the primary reasons why I went in the first place is because my father was a World War II veteran.
Do you trust that if we did it, it would be fair?
But see, that's the problem, Tom. I don't believe, as in the past with Vietnam, it was not equitable. You look at our vice president. He had better things to do. And Rush Limbaugh, it goes on and on. And yet these are the people today who are waving the flag and calling people who... that are against the war in Iraq unpatriotic. But this is the problem. I mean, where everybody you get to go.
So you're saying make it universal if you do it.
Or some disability.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think again, going back to the comment you made earlier, this needs to be a wake-up call for the me generation. After 9/11 and even when Iraq geared up, young people that I know that certainly are eligible weren't running down to the recruiting stations in droves.
And they were not asked to run down their doors. We're almost out of time, but I thank you for your call. Thanks very much for calling in. Charles Moskos, just a few seconds left here, but we're talking about this as though it's an optional item, and Donald Rumsfeld says so, but Chuck Hagel, I go back to the senator, he's saying we are going to break our military if we don't get some more numbers in there. Is there some way other than the draft to do that?
I don't see how, except, and it would be interesting to get David Greenberg to comment on it. There's another way, which might be the next option, which will come up. So we've already used the civilian contractors. How about just hire foreigners? And I think you can get hundreds of thousands of Gurkha-type people.
Or Hessians.
Hessians who would be love to come to America for a citizenship and a decent salary.
We've just got a few seconds, David Greenberg.
David,
it's facetious, but what do you think, David? How do we supply the numbers that the military needs?
Well, I mean, I would certainly defer to Professor Moskos as sort of the expert on those kinds of matters. But I would say that when we go into Iraq and war is of choice, it was not necessary to put so many American soldiers at risk and make such a long-term commitment there as we now have done.
Boy, the argument's gone the other way, though, that we didn't have enough in the first place. I'd love to pursue it, but we're out of time. David Greenberg of Yale, thank you. And Charles Moskos of Northwestern, thank you to you both for being with
thank
us
you.
Tonight.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Listeners, you can continue this conversation on our website at onpointradio.org. Coming up, Jack Beatty joins me with a look at the news of the week. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
They had a lot of good questions, and I'm glad I did it. I'm glad I took the time. This is an important commission, and it's important that I ask the questions they ask so that they can help make recommendations necessary to better protect our homeland.
The government asked this court for a broad ruling that would allow the president unlimited power to imprison any American anywhere at any time without trial, simply by labeling him an enemy combatant.
There is a unique interest, especially in the course of this conflict, where intelligence is at an unprecedented value, to have some ability with some detainees to deal with them in a way that allows us to get intelligence to prevent future terrorist attacks.
I think that we should be very careful in thinking that this effort to build this Iraqi capacity will necessarily calm down the situation in Fallujah tonight or over the next several days.
A year ago, I did get the speech from the carrier saying that we had achieved an important objective, that we had accomplished a mission, which was the removal of Saddam Hussein. And as a result, there are no longer torture chambers or rape rooms or mass graves in Iraq.
This is against human rights, and the American, they say that they protect human rights. They should take their, they should be punished, you know, the persons who has done this to our prisoners.
Beyond his struggle to maintain a position on Iraq, Senator Kerry's record raises serious doubts about his understanding of the broader struggle against terror, of which Iraq is only one front.
This is a moment of truth in Iraq, not just for this administration, the country, the Iraqi people, but for the world. This may be our last chance to get it right.
And there's a week President Bush and Dick Cheney are questioned by the 9/11 Commission for 3 hours behind closed doors. The Supreme Court hears arguments over whether the government can indefinitely detain American citizens who are deemed enemy combatants. After another week of fighting, U.S. Marines handed some responsibility for pursuing insurgents in Fallujah over to an Iraqi brigade commanded by former officers of Saddam Hussein's army. President Bush defends his flight deck speech a year ago, declaring an end to major combat in Iraq. An Iraqi governing council member expresses outrage over abuses allegedly perpetrated by American soldiers at an Iraqi prison. Vice President Cheney rails against John Kerry's national security record in a speech at Westminster College. And at that same venue today, John Kerry laid out his vision for what to do in Iraq and said the military is facing a moment of truth. It sure felt like a moment of truth this week, Jack.
It sure did. It looks like, and fingers crossed, that the Marines have made a tactical retreat in the face of a what would really be a strategic defeat, namely a battle for Fallujah. anything to put that poison chalice from them.
Trying to soft shoe their way out of there by getting the Iraqis in.
That's right. That's right. And more power to them. You know, Douglas MacArthur, he didn't attack strong points. He just went around them. I mean, on New Guinea, he bypassed Rabaul and other places. So this is there's a long military tradition of not doing things that are going to just do nothing but hurt you. And I'm glad to see that that sense has prevailed there.
Maybe, we'll hope that it works. But, of course, New Guinea and the islands that MacArthur hopped over were not part of the country that he needed to subdue. Najaf and Fallujah are critical.
That's certainly true, but we've got the primary problem there of legitimacy and whether the people there are willing to accede to an American, must feel to them like an American conquest. There's a Sufi singer whose ballads were being sung by the people who hung the four contractors, and his recording, his CD, is being handed out all over the country. It's called Kadab, Rage, and one lyric goes, "Who invited you, O Bush, to the land of Fallujah, which will give you the chalice of death?"
John Kerry looking to pick up this issue today and offer his big solution. Get NATO in there, get a UN chief in charge where Paul Bremer has been, and a massive effort to pump up Iraqi security forces.
Yes, and, you know, this is something like what Joe Biden was talking about a few weeks ago, although it's chimerical. I mean, the fact is there aren't any NATO forces to speak of. The UN isn't going to get in there after these disasters. And this is a kind of this is Kerry's effort sort of ex post facto to say, oh, I want to do it in a multilateral way. Well, it's almost too late for all that, I think. I don't know that he's going to get any response from the administration. At least the administration, give them the credit. They are, in the face of this disaster, shifting policy rapidly, giving way on one bad decision after another and correcting it in the field.
Maybe. We'll see. Remains to be seen how effective that will be. I mean, Fallujah, we still have to see what happens when those Iraqi soldiers go in there. Meanwhile, back in Washington, the president and his vice president joined at the hip before the 9/11 commission, the commission whose work he resisted for so long.
Yes. And the president apologized or said he regretted the Justice Department's hanging, really calumny, of Jamie Gorelick. I mean, people who've looked into this wall that she was supposed to have erected that Attorney General Ashcroft said was the problem in fighting terrorism. She didn't erect it. It wasn't the problem. Goes back to the 80s. She just formulated it. It's a complete calumny. It's still on the website, though, of the Justice Department.
Jack, I had a wonderful stroll across the mall in Washington yesterday, and by accident came upon the first open day of the World War II monument there, the much-disputed, controversial monument. People thought it would mess up the view of the mall between the Washington Monument and Lincoln Memorial. I can tell you it is stately. It's got an amazing sunken view of the reflecting pool in front of the Lincoln Memorial. It puts you at eye level with the surface of that pool. The critics say it's too square and too old-fashioned. But walking from that monument over to the Vietnam Memorial, which is so different, that dark gash in the earth is so affecting in its own way, I couldn't help but think no one will be able to help but wonder where this whole effort in Iraq will fall between those two sort of poles of American military action globally. One stately and proud, whatever you think of the design, and the other such a dark wound even now. A lot for all Americans to think about as they eventually make that same stroll, and I'm sure that many will.
Oh, and what a symbol that is, isn't it? But they're both below ground. One, I gather, not in dark marble.
Nope, gleaming white marble against the black marble of Vietnam, and Iraq's story yet to be told. That future thundering toward us in these last couple of weeks. Jack, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.